welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clemente, former New York City prosecutor and retired FBI profiler, and I'm here to talk about, again, the People versus O.J. Simpson. And with me today is...
Laura Richards, founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service, author and also criminal behavioral analyst.
And Lisa Zambetti, I'm the casting director for Criminal Minds, where I work with my colleague Jim Clemente.
Well, it's great to have you back today to talk about episode 9 of People versus O.J. Simpson. Now, the title of this episode in the series is called Manna from Heaven, and that will be basically the statement that the defense makes when they find out that there are actually pretty horrific, not pretty horrific, absolutely horrific tapes of Detective Furman being not only racially bigoted, but misogynistic as well. So we'll be getting into this episode right from the start. And I think the first thing that happened in the episode was an example of what I've been talking about the defense team. That is, they showed an exercise video of O.J. Simpson that he had recorded just a few weeks before the murders. And this is after the defense presented an expert who basically alleged that O.J. Simpson was so old and so battered that he could no longer actually even barely walk, much less do the physical actions necessary to kill Ron Goldman.
The doctor likened him to Tarzan's grandfather, due apparently to his arthritis.
Yeah, it was so bad that he couldn't do this murder. And then, lo and behold, you have O.J. smiling and dancing, jazzercising it up, even making really bad jokes. Right, Laura?
Yeah, I mean, certainly he's never one to pass up an endorsement opportunity and give motivational speeches. But what was left out of the series was quite an interesting joke that he made, which actually did end up being entered into evidence by the prosecution, which was him making a joke about beating up his wife. And, you know, he basically turned around and said, "I'm telling you, you just got to get your own space if you're working out with the wife, if you know what I mean. You could always blame it on, working out." So, you know, even when he's making a video and, you know, a public video, he's trivializing and minimizing and just making it something that's just very run of the mill, which says a lot about his mindset.
Yeah, he's shameless. I mean, he has absolutely no, he's almost like, can't even understand why that's wrong.
Right. No fear of the consequence.
Yeah, we'll definitely get into that later when we see his statements and interviews after the trial ends. But the thing that I was really thrown by in this, or actually I guess I should have expected it by now, but the fact that there is absolutely zero consequences to the defense for putting on an expert, a quote expert in inverted commas, as Laura would say, who swears to tell the truth, swears that he's a medical professional, swears that O.J. could not have physically done this, when in fact that's a complete and bold-faced lie. There is absolutely no way that that is a truthful statement. There's no way that they can actually back that up. But there are absolutely no negative consequences to the defense from putting this liar on the stand.
It's basically perjury, right?
Right. I mean, this guy was not charged with perjury, even though, I mean, literally, at the same time that O.J. supposedly was being examined by this guy, he was doing these jazzercise videos. I mean, come on, it's ridiculous. It's just outrageous. But they get to lie and do whatever they want, and they are completely unaddressed by
Judge
Ito. It
makes a mockery of the whole process, doesn't it?
It is. I mean, if you're going to demand justice from the system, honesty from the system, you have to put in the same thing. I mean, it's so hypocritical to not put it in. The system should be just. The system should be honest. The system should be unbiased. But it certainly doesn't help when you actually abuse the system, lie,
manipulate things.
Manipulate things. And boy, this episode is filled with manipulation. So I guess we should move on to the second part. Basically, I called it sort of Darden versus Cochran this episode, because there was a lot of that sort of back and forth between the two of them. I think from my perspective, it looks like Cochran is doing it totally for show, but Darden seems to really feel passionate about what he's arguing for, whereas it's sort of like snickering behind closed doors with Cochran. But I think the fact is, in reality, Cochran is very effective. He's a great public speaker, meaning he has to know the law to do the legal part of it, but not every lawyer has the verbal skills and the audacity even to do and say the things that he's done in courtroom and outside the courtroom. That's a whole nother story in this case.
Yeah, well, Darden's just going, shooting, a straight line and going for the truth. And I guess that harks back to what his, father said to him, that it's going to be a very messy battle and don't get caught up in it. But he feels morally, bound to do the right thing. So, he calls Cochran out with quiet dignity, in inverted commas. Mm-hmm. That's what Jeffrey Toobin said, and he talked about it creating a huge amount of problems for his family and for himself when he makes it about, Darden and race.
Right. So that's the whole thing. I mean, this, I think, was a deliberate strategy, certainly proposed by and executed by Mr. Cochran. The show, at least, makes it appear as though Shapiro did not want to play the race card, as it were. But I'm not sure how that actually played out in the real world. But I definitely believe, there's a scene in here where he fights against them wanting to go down and getting the tapes from, I think it was South Carolina, where?
Yeah, we had the ego fight going on.
Right. And so he wanted to go, but at first he was fighting against it. And there were people on the Dream Team.
So it's North Carolina.
North Carolina, sorry. I was just in South Carolina. That was my mistake. I was at Fort Bragg this past week. But that there seemed to be some dissension scripted into this show about whether or not they should even try to get these tapes. Well, I believe that everybody on the defense team saw them literally as a gift from heaven, and I don't think anybody would have fought against any attempt to get them. Here's the problem, though. I mean, what actually are these tapes? What do they actually depict?
The other thing, Jim, actually, which is interesting, because manna from heaven wasn't Cochran's phrase. That's not what he used. And it was actually, he described the tapes to the judge of saying that the tapes are just like Lay's potato chips. You can't put them down and you can't just eat one. And he said that there was almost mystical joy in the tapes' discoveries. But I like the title, Manna from Heaven.
Yeah.
And of course, it's a hark back to Making a Murderer, the hand of God again. Mm-hmm. But certainly they had some luck with this phone call, of discovering these tapes in the first place from the screenwriter, Laura McKinney, who had used Furman as a consultant, in inverted commas, for a screenplay that she was working on about women police officers, which obviously ended up as 13 Hours, known as the Furman tapes.
Right. And here's the thing. Was Furman, first of all, let's all say this. These tapes are horrific. They're offensive in every way possible. As human beings, as a former law enforcement officer, as a former prosecutor, as a person, they're offensive in every way. And the fact that he was bold enough to say these things while he's being recorded just shows his arrogance.
Just like OJ, shameless, yeah.
As well as his bigotry and racism and probably a dozen other things. But the fact is that he was talking to someone who was writing a screenplay. Was he actually telling the truth in these tapes? Was he actually recounting real events? Or was he boasting to a screenplay writer so that he could be involved in this whole Hollywood process? I don't know. It's probably somewhere in between. What do you think?
Well, I think it's a really good point. And, and certainly when you track back to those incidents or the things that he says, many of them didn't happen or they happened in a different way. So the corroboration, it certainly looks like embellishment. And is it for the purposes of, you know, him trying to be helpful and wanting to, you know, be part of creating something? Or is it him talking, using facts, but then embellishing it just solely for the purpose of, you know, this particular project?
Yes.
I don't know, but it certainly seems interesting that, you know, he's borrowed some of the facts and then has put a lot of other things on top of it, that those things didn't really happen the way he describes.
But whether they did or happen or not, it certainly goes to his state of mind about his opinions about
absolutely.
These people. I mean, whether he really did those things or not.
Right. It absolutely does. And again, he is a despicable human being and certainly had no right ever being a cop and should
never. But I want to lay the marker down on, you know, it's not just racism, it's extreme sexism as well.
Right.
And I do think, you know, a lot of the times we miss out the sexism in these conversations and we look at just one part of it and make it one-dimensional. But actually, you know, he was misogynistic. He was incredibly sexist, the things that he said about women. And that has no place in any workforce.
Absolutely. And so we should get into the actual issue that sort of ruled the day in terms of misogynistic statements by him. And that was about Judge Ito's wife. And the fact that there are offensive statements against Judge Ito's wife, and the fact that Judge Ito's wife had risen to a rank in the police department where she was in a position to reprimand.
Well, she was one of the highest ranking women in the LAPD at the time.
Right. And she did reprimand Furman in the past. However, when she signed her disclosure form at the beginning of the case, which allowed Ito to be actually confirmed to do this trial, either she forgot about Furman or she deliberately didn't want to disclose that. She didn't want to get her husband disqualified for this case.
And the way the drama showed it was, you know, there was a pause over her pen as she was looking down those significant witnesses. So it almost intimated, or it was a certain nod to the fact that there was something going on there, that she did know one of them.
Well, she certainly had a responsibility to find out if she did. Mm-hmm. Not just know him, but actually reprimand him mm-hmm. in the past for improper behavior. And so the fact that she didn't do that actually created a tremendous problem and a conflict of interest for Ito, and I believe he should have declared a mistrial at that point. There's no way that what happened, the fallout from that, I mean, it even gets more absurd. It's just outrageous what he did right after that, but we'll get to that in a minute because I don't want to just, you know, drive by this issue of his misogynistic statements and his behavior, because the fact is that he was pissed because she was in a position of power over him. And he didn't think that women should be. It's so, you know, incredibly wrong. It's so much the kind of bias that creates situations where people who are in law enforcement take advantage of other people because of their position of power. It is exactly why people in a position of power should not be people who have biases and racism and ego problems, real big ego issues, or sadistic issues, for example.
Mm.
And some of the things that he was saying in his statements were very sadistic, and he was bragging about it. It's just horrible. And it horrified me just that this guy actually had the audacity and the arrogance to speak that to somebody who was recording these statements. Can you imagine what he said in private to other people that aren't recording him? So he's not a good guy. But we'll talk about it in a little bit, how that doesn't really affect this case. Because, in fact, the cops, there were four police officers on the scene who had located the hat and the glove and the blood trail at Bundy, at the crime scene. The only thing that Furman discovered on his own was the glove at Rockingham. And had Marshall Clark listened to the, I think, the sage advice from Darden that this guy was not the kind of person we want to put on the stand. Mm-hmm. He has issues. I get a really bad feeling for him from him. Had she listened and just cut out that piece of evidence, she was so willing to cut out an eyewitness who saw OJ driving the Bronco at the time, right after the murders happened. She was so willing to just excise that from her case, but she wouldn't excise that second glove.
So you really don't think that she needed him? You think that?
Not at all. Mm. Not at all. She could have put those four police officers on the stand. It would have been just as, or it would have been much more effective, actually.
I mean, it's really the matter of due diligence, isn't it? Of understanding, you know, who your witnesses are and doing that due diligence. And I agree with you, Jim. You know, when you've got, there was overwhelming forensic evidence and other people who collected that he probably wasn't, they made him much more significant and they made him a very easy target. He was low-hanging fruit for the defense team.
Right. There was an, excuse me, there was a kind of a confrontation between Darden and Marsha Clark in an elevator, in which Darden says, you wanted a black person on the team, not a black voice. And I think this is what he was talking about, that I knew fundamentally and viscerally that this guy was trouble. He didn't even know about the depth of it, and he certainly didn't know about these tapes out there.
But it was instinctive and sixth sense.
Yeah, and I think that she dismissed it because Darden was not an experienced prosecutor, and Darden was sort of new to the team and so forth. But it's another one of those things that you mentioned. If Bill had not had a heart attack, he would have still been there. He was a very seasoned prosecutor, and he would have balanced out sort of Marsha's decisions, I think. But instead, I think she took on all these decisions herself, didn't think them through, didn't do her due diligence, and ended up, I mean, this is, the whole Furman issue became one of the most pivotal issues in this trial. And again, it gets even more outrageous. Stay tuned. So I wanted to also discuss the depiction of the hearing that that F. Lee Bailey and Johnny Cochran had down south in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. They show that the first judge basically summarily dismissed the motion after Johnny Cochran argued for it. And I'm not sure if that's true, but it certainly could have happened. And it, either way, it does point out something that in the Deep South, I mean,
it was denied. Yeah. So
okay, great.
It says that that's a true fact, that Judge Ito had issued a subpoena for the tapes, but the judge, William Wood Jr., inexplicably, in inverted commas, denied them.
Mm-hmm. And it could have been just that they didn't want California messing with their citizens and so forth. And I can imagine if he had anticipated what would actually happen with these tapes, he would have been even more adamant in his denial. But I don't know if it had to do with Johnny Cochran and his attitude and his sort of cockiness in front of the court. Saying
showmanship.
Yeah, showmanship. He said, Judge, can I approach the bench? And Judge says, no, stay where you are. Like, he wasn't doing what Ito did, which is bend over backwards for him. Or if the denial had anything to do with his race. It certainly could have. And as I was saying, I think that it just puts sort of an exclamation point on the fact that there is still some very overt racism in the South. And I know a lot of people who I know say they experience much less overt racism in the North, but it's sort of more hidden and insidious, and maybe in the West as well. But the fact is that when you have a situation where judges have that kind of power and can be unchecked in basically, you know, throwing their biases into the decision, that's a corrupt system. That's not a good system. And one of the things that I've noticed in my career in law enforcement, which is over 25 years, that race is certainly one issue that comes up. But an issue that this case really highlights is the fact that wealthy people have a much better chance of getting the result they want in court than poor people do. And I think that is a major divide. And of course, there's also a racial divide that I think this show was really trying to point out. So this issue and the fact that that Effie Bailey then gets up and sort of sweets talks to them about their college teams and their mint juleps and so forth, that's it's sort of a cultural clash. Johnny was not used to that. Effie Bailey was. And I think that it's just an opportunity to show that it's actually multi-level, the distinction between sort of a big city West Coast or East Coast lawyer and a Southern lawyer who knows how to charm a judge and a jury.
I wanted to ask a question. Is this also where cross-cultural communication comes into play?
Yeah, I think it is. It's one example of it, mm-hmm. Sure. I mean, let's face it. If Effie Bailey hadn't had a tremendous amount of experience working down in the South, he may not have known how to sort of sweet talk, in this case, the appellate panel, into granting his motion. But the fact is that he was used to working in the South. I'm sure he didn't know it instinctively until he had an opportunity to work there and get to see how some of those lawyers were. I remember as a kid, my father coming back after being involved in a hearing in Texas, and somebody came up to him, a lawyer came up to him, like a cowboy hat on and stuff, and said, "Are you Peter Clementi?" And he said, "Yeah." And he said, "Oh, I just wanted to see and meet a real city slicker lawyer, you know." And to them, you know, we're outsiders. We don't necessarily feel like outsiders when we go somewhere else, but people from New York are probably a little more direct and brash and in your face than people down south. And I think that is a cross-cultural mm-hmm. issue, as well as racial differences can be cross-cultural issues. But it certainly doesn't mean that every single person in a particular race or from a particular culture acts the same way or doesn't act appropriately in a situation. It's just one of the things that they tried to write to in this particular episode. And I thought it was interesting just to bring up that point. And I also think it's interesting what ended up happening with these tapes, because for me, that's outrageous. But
And apparently Bailey, you know, the decision to send him in the end came down to him saying that he would pay his own personal expenses. So that was the defining card for Cochrane of putting him on a plane, because he was paying his own way.
It all comes down to money, huh? Well, I wonder, though, if when Shapiro told him that he was going to be doing it pro bono, if he actually stuck to that. I don't know. Or did OJ eventually come out of his pocket and pay Effie Bailey for his services? It's an interesting question.
Well, he certainly paid his own way on that plane. That was his standard trump card, apparently, to get on the plane. But he did have a good history of trying cases in North Carolina. So probably a no-brainer on both of those things.
When the tapes did get back to L.A. and the defense listened to them, they had to bring the prosecution in because they found that Furman had bad mouth and made some very derogatory comments about Judge Ito's wife. And then that unearthed the prior interactions between Judge Ito's wife and Furman. And of course, that became a huge issue. And Judge Ito's noted as saying, "There's an implication that Peggy lied so that I could be on this case." So instead of doing what he should have done, which is saying, "So I'm recusing myself from this case from now on, and I am going to have to declare a mistrial," he didn't do that. He said, "I'm going to let another judge decide whether I am biased or not," based on these tapes. Yeah. That just, to me, that's the whole reason why you have sort of a Chinese wall that you build between people who have a relationship with people who are involved in this case and people who don't. I mean, you don't ever let something like that get in your way, because even if, let's just say that the tapes never came out, but later on, let's say OJ was convicted. Later on, a defense attorney, an appellate attorney, would just have to find out that Ito, his wife, had improperly or, you know, on purpose filled out this form. They could have gotten a new trial based on that. They could have thrown out that whole trial based on that. So the fact that he had this conflict, the fact that he was so distressed at this situation, I mean, proves that he is just too close to it because these are statements about his wife.
But this was a major soap opera twist, wasn't it? I mean, you know, who would have seen that coming? There's enough drama in this case alone. And, you know, I don't recall hearing about this.
I didn't know about it.
So, you know, I think what they've also done is expose some other things that probably most of the public didn't know about. And, you know, the fact that Judge Ito then talks about sexism and sort of pays tribute to his wife and women in, you know, law enforcement and tough professions. But yet, every time we see decisions being made, they seem to be on a negative connotation to Marcia, who equally is a woman in a tough profession doing a tough job.
Right.
So he seems to have, for me, a double standard. But I did think it was interesting what he said. And this is what Marcia said about it from her memoir, Without Doubt, because he basically said that, you know, women do have a tough time and they have to be much tougher in law enforcement professions, which I absolutely agree with, having worked in one. But Marcia actually says, Judge Ito then began speaking of the difficult road that women had to walk in a man's profession, how women take a lot of hits for having to be tough. The irony of it left me breathless. For a year now, I'd been browbeaten by this man, suffering the very difficulties that moistened his eyes when he spoke of his wife. Oh, when it suited his Kodak moment, he was Mr. Sensitivity.
Oh, wow. Well, that's pretty telling. Yeah, I mean, she's the one that actually had to deal with him directly and saw his just disdain at times. Certainly, most of the decisions that were critical in this case were made for the defense and against the prosecution. And she was the lead prosecutor. You would think that if he had some kind of sensitivity, some real sensitivity, and it wasn't just word service, that he would have actually listened to her more.
I mean, you know, it's a complete double standard. But what Furman was saying was that, you know, his wife had, you know, basically slept her way to the top. And that's something, you know, sadly, you hear all too often with successful females that, you know, they didn't get there on merit. And I think for me, what the show has done particularly well, again, the sexism angle is something that you just, you know that it goes on, but very few shows actually tackle that. So I think that they did it in a way that really did bring the issues to bear. And I think this, you know, isn't just about race. It's about the isms, you know, and any of these isms have no place. And, you know, so when people do talk about this is race, this is celebrity, for me, there's another ism that we always need to be talking about, which is sexism.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the minimizing of Nicole as a victim, as a person, you know, taking all of the furniture and any evidence that she was a mother out of her apartment and having the jury go through that stark area. I mean, that was certainly, you know, it definitely affected their opinion of her. And then this book that came out, and then Judge Ito has everybody read it. It makes absolutely no sense that he would give it that much weight, that he would have every, you know, all the lawyers.
Faye Resnick's book, you're talking
about. Faye Resnick's book, yeah.
I mean, the images of Marcia, you know, the leak of her topless, all these things are about controlling, you know, women, which actually is what this trial should have been about. And yet here we have, you know, all these examples peppered throughout. You know, we talked about the Marcia episode.
Right, I mean, it's just focusing on her hair and her style and her dress. I mean, it's just outrageous. I mean, how could you possibly legitimately, as a news service, cover that kind of crap? I mean, it's just ridiculous.
Sadly, it's all there to undermine, and we know who was peddling it, because it's there to undermine her as a person. It's very personal. It's not just professional. It's a very personal attack.
Right. It also gave the general public license to treat her a certain way. I think they depicted that she was shopping. This is like something that really happened, and buying feminine products, and the cashier's like, oh, is it going to be a bitchy day in court today or something to that effect. I mean, really?
Yeah.
Just unbelievable. But Jim, I did have a quick question. I don't know if it should go here or not. But as far as Furman goes, you know, the minute that he sees that Ito is the seated judge for this, shouldn't he be? Of course, he should be recusing himself because he knows that he worked for the wife. And isn't there a punishment for him for not?
No, a cop can't recuse himself from if he gets called as a witness. He's getting called by the prosecution. He doesn't make a decision to go into court.
But if he disclosed it.
Right. Sorry. Yeah. Right. So he would have to disclose it to the prosecutor. He didn't do that.
Right.
Right. So it's just not, all I'm saying is the timing of it. He can't do it like in court. He can't just say, I'm recusing myself. Uh-huh. But he had a duty to disclose that, of course, to the prosecutor. And had he told Darden would have been able to yell and scream and shout a lot more to Marcia about why we shouldn't call this guy. Yeah. So he threw the prosecution under the bus by not disclosing that and not disclosing the fact that he was a raging racist and sexist and probably a bunch of other ists.
I would say every ist is probably present in...
You're probably right. You're probably right.
Sadly.
So one thing that really made me mad was the fact that Johnny Cochran took it upon himself while Judge Ito and this other judge were deciding their motions on the Furman tapes to call a press conference and to get out a bunch of African-American leaders to express outrage and demand a federal investigation. Doing this publicly, if he had actually wanted to get a federal investigation done, he could have easily called up the FBI or one of the other federal agencies and gotten an investigation started. But what he wanted was to influence Judge Ito and the other judge and making the determination on this motion. And I think it's outrageous conduct. He should have been held in contempt of court for doing that. This was not an issue that he had any reason to be able to try to manipulate the public on, yet he did it. And he did it in a way, the way they depicted in this show, when he saw the social unrest that it was causing, he was very happy about that.
He was, and it was a covert way of inciting people to riot.
Right.
And pushing forward other community leaders, and him stood at the back of them. And, you know, it was almost like a veiled
threat to
incite people. And I am absolutely, aghast that he wasn't held in contempt. I mean, how that would play out, a trial that is live and putting that pressure on Judge Ito. But again, he got the desired outcome that he was seeking.
Judge Ito did not take control of that courtroom, and he certainly did not take control of those lawyers. And any other high-profile case, you see them all the time, where lawyers are under strict gag orders about what's going on in the courtroom. Now, this stuff was a motion that Ito had to decide, and this other judge had to decide, in privacy, in their own chambers, with doing their own research and so forth. But instead of allowing the justice system to work in the way it was intended, he decided that he was going to tell the world about it. As a result, Judge Ito made the most asinine decision that he made in the whole trial, as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, no, there's one more.
Oh, is there
one more decision that Judge Ito took, which for me is the showstopper.
Right. In this part of the series, up to this point of the series, it was the most asinine decision. And that was, he decided that although he was only going to play a few sentences from these 13 hours of tapes, of Furman tapes, for the jury, he was going to play in the courtroom for the public and all the news agencies, the entire 13 hours of the tapes. So they took 13 hours and they played all these tapes to the world. Now think about this. They got a subpoena that a judge initially denied in North Carolina, and then an appellate judge said, okay, you can have these Judge Itos for review to determine if you're going to put them into evidence. Nobody gave him the right to play these to the world. This is somebody's intellectual property. She's a writer. This is her story.
Right.
She was actually trying to sell these tapes to somebody. And he ripped that out. That's illegal. He cannot do that. And yet he did it. And this is why I said, this might be why the judge in North Carolina denied the motion initially. Because these are hot topic tapes and his citizen owned them. And to give that property to a judge in California, where he then lost all control of it, and Judge Ito then to make a decision that these are basically part of the national, what do you say, the national interest or something? I mean, absolutely not. It inflamed the national interest. But if he actually wanted to do something good with these tapes, if he thought that these tapes showed corruption in the Los Angeles Police Department, what he should have done is notified the court in North Carolina that he was turning them over to the FBI for an investigation. But instead, he plays them to the world. He has no right to do that. Just absolutely no right. And if I were that woman who got these tapes taken from me, I would have sued Judge Ito and the California justice system for millions of dollars, because...
But she didn't want to be a part of it,
right.
She didn't want them at all. She wasn't cooperating.
Used at all.
No, she wasn't cooperating with giving the tapes to the...
Defense.
But she was actively trying to sell them other places. That's how people found out. That's how the investigator for the defense team found out about him, as far as I'm aware. And so the fact is that they stole these tapes from her and published them. It's like you're writing a book, and Judge Ito decided to publish it, take it away from you and your publisher, and publish the book. It's just outrageous.
So, I mean, I agree with you, Jim. Playing that in court, you know, means that the whole world hears those things. And it's not the fact that the jury aren't there, because, of course, they're being visited by their family and by people, you know, I think on every Friday. So that information would still find its way, into the jury domain.
Right. This trial took place over 9 months, so there were a lot of family visits and information. You know, you can't prevent that from happening. Now, the rules are that you're not allowed to. You can try to, but you can't actually do that. But so Judge Ito allowed three sentences that demonstrated that not only was Furman lying when he said he never used the N-word, he also was lying about how, what he would do or wouldn't do in order to...
And his prejudicial and racist views, and that's what was played in court.
So the jury never knew about Ito's conflict of interest at all. That was not even...
They didn't know the detail of it, because those discussions all happened when they weren't there. But of course, you know, I have to say I wasn't aware of it either. I don't think many people were aware of those things. And that's the good thing, actually, about the dramatisation of this show, if there is something good about it. And as I've always said, there's not enough about the victims in the show. And certainly, you know, in terms of them raising issues and the drama of how it's played out, it does have a place, and it has started dialogue, you know, on these really important issues.
So I think that Ito bent once again over backwards, allowed Johnny Cochran to create a firestorm around these tapes, with the specific purpose of influencing Ito's decision. He not only allowed him to get away with it, but then he made the decision that Cochran wanted in the first place. So it's just, it was never an issue of national concern until Johnny Cochran made that sort of almost threat to riot if they weren't played, and if...
I mean, it felt like the sword of Damocles to me. When I, you know, for Judge Ito, it felt like the sword of Damocles. He was being given an ultimatum, effectively.
Yeah.
And Ito would have been weighing all of that up. Not that, you know, I understand most of his decision-making, because I have to say I do not. Certainly, you know, with the dossier for Nicole's, you know, abuse history, I still cannot wrap my head around how that decision or why that decision was made. But certainly with this, the way that it's been portrayed is that Ito had a lot to think about, and Johnny Cochran smells the blood. And again, you know, he goes for the jugular, using the press, because he is a ringmaster spin doctor, and he uses the tool that we've seen him use throughout,
right,
to get people on his side and also put people under pressure to make decisions in his favour.
Right, and obviously he has absolutely no negative ramifications. It just, he does whatever he wants, and he keeps doing it and doing it and doing it.
So he calls back Furman to the stand. Furman goes back on the stand, and what happens?
Well, he takes the Fifth. He says he's not going to answer any questions on the basis of his Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. And so, of course, they ask a few questions, and then they come back and ask, did you ever plant evidence in any case, and he takes the fifth on that. Now, the reason why he took the fifth...
Okay, I was going to ask you, why in the hell would he have to do that?
Well, if he invokes the Fifth Amendment on a question and then answers another question, mm-hmm. it could create a situation in which he would have to answer all questions at that point.
Mm. So it opens
it's
the
more
the door.
Consistency and continuity, isn't it?
Well,
for all of those questions that he's asked, even though, you know, is one question more significant than the others? Well, people wanted him to say no to the planting of evidence, but what does that say to the others? So the consistency and continuity of the blanket Fifth Amendment, we don't have that back in the UK, but we can have someone who decides not to, you know, give any further information on something, but we don't have the Fifth Amendment.
Yeah, so basically, if he had said, I'm going to take the fifth on the first, second, and third question, but not on the fourth question, the implication is that instead of protecting his rights, that he's actually giving away the fact that he did lie in those first three incidents, and that on this fourth incident, because he doesn't have to lie to answer it, then he will answer that one. So you basically have a catch-22. They knew they were talking him into a corner, asking him those questions first, and then doing the coup de grace question, because they knew at that point, since he had already invoked the fifth, that anything he said after that, any question he answered after that, would make it appear that instead of, when you invoke the fifth, it's like, I don't have to answer this, so I won't. So I'm not giving you anything, even though the appearance is negative. But if he answers one after taking the fifth on a bunch of others, then it does look like he was lying before, and he's actually incriminating himself by behavior instead of by the words that come out of his mouth.
It just seems shocking to me that, I mean, he knows that the tapes are out there. Everybody's heard them. He knows that everybody thinks that he's a racist, everything else. But the one thing that hopefully wasn't true is that he planted this. So it just shocks me that he wouldn't, on that question, want everybody to know that his police work was above suspicion.
Yeah, but the last thing that... that his lawyers would ever advise him to do would be to answer that question on the stand.
He's been undermined and discredited. I mean, there's nowhere for him to go on after those tapes. Although, I mean, interestingly, it does say about the tapes, we were talking about just the content of them, that out of the 29 incidents or issues that were on the tapes and transcripts, 17 of them could not be connected to known events in his career or other of his colleagues, or either his colleagues' careers. But investigators did link 12 accounts to known events, but produced no conclusive findings except for the fact that he was racist and sexist towards female co-workers.
Right. So it sounds like he was bragging. Now, get me absolutely clear on this. I want to be very clear that one incident like this is horrendous. He should never have been a cop because of that. 12 incidents where he was that way. I mean, I don't know why he wasn't fired earlier, and hooray for Judge Ito's wife actually reprimanding him, but I think it should have been a little more severe, the consequences.
It wasn't a formal admonishment either. It was an informal
reprimand. Yeah, they were probably trying to give him another chance. But the fact is that some of them, these incidents that he talked about on the tapes, appear to be just boastful, that he was actually kind of rolling with it and giving her what she wanted to hear when he didn't actually do it. So he was bragging, but it shows his state of mind, as you pointed out earlier, Lisa, that this is the kind of thing he's proud of. And that's just so bad.
Yeah. So I think one of the other interesting and great scenes of episode 9 was where Chris Darden sort of enters into a disagreement with Cochrane. And it was actually about the cross-examination of Detective Lang. And the Judge Ito instructs Darden to calm down and take three deep breaths. And he refuses to apologise to the judge for his behaviour. And then you have Marcia sort of in solidarity saying that, you know, should she remove her jewellery and go to jail with Darden? And I think it's an interesting scene because it's pointing and nudging to, you know, the moral fibre of both of them, of what they're prepared to do to try and have a voice and stand up and, you know, and say something when they're disagreeing with Ito, because they're just flying through storms.
Yeah, I think it, and what I wrote down in my notes at that point was they're both totally fed up with Ito. I mean, after, can you imagine 9 months of this going on? I mean, it's just every single ruling goes against them. There are some judges that will constantly rule against the prosecution, because if a defendant is convicted, anything that the judge does to help the prosecution can be a point of appeal. Mm-hmm. They will look at that and say, the judge made a wrong ruling, this favored the prosecution, didn't give him a fair trial, new trial. So there, some judges are extremely careful about doing anything favoring the prosecution. Most of the time, you don't have defense attorneys who will go as far as these guys have, pushing and pushing and pushing and doing things outside of the court and manipulating the court in such a way that it's just outrageous behavior. In this case, Ito let all of that through and made most of the decisions in favor of the defense.
I mean, the storm's in the courtroom, but it's also outside of the courtroom, and there's seemingly, you know, nothing that they can do to maneuver themselves. You know, even when they are trying to challenge him, it comes down on the other side consistently.
And, right. You know, a perfect example is when the fact that Cochran had been domestically abusive to his wife, and he's able to shut that down, and it never even makes a ripple in the pond. But when he wants to get his way, when these tapes are coming in, he goes outside of the court and holds a press conference and creates this national issue out of something that was actually a motion in a courtroom. I mean, it should have been decided in that courtroom. It wasn't decided in that courtroom.
But the rules don't apply to him, you see, Jim, just like someone else that we know. And I think there's a great nod again to that in the finale, which we're going to talk about, which comes with the closing speeches.
Yeah.
It's my last question to you, Jim.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that Mark Furman planted that glove or planted any of the evidence?
I don't think that would have been possible. Where would he have gotten it from? I mean, you can't. I mean, honestly, where would Furman have gotten that glove? Right. Are you saying he picked it up at
the
crime
scene? I'm just.
No,
the blood. I mean,
That's a rhetorical question. Mm-hmm. Do people believe that he found it at the first crime scene and said, "Hey, I'm going to take it and go to OJ's house, just in case OJ is there, and he doesn't have a lock solid alibi because." He would have to, of course, have known at the time he picked it up from Bundy that OJ was in residence at that house. And actually, because what if OJ was at a bar for the last 15 hours signing postcards? Then he would have had to take that glove and put it over there.
Right.
He would be risking getting arrested and thrown in jail.
Yeah, he'd have to be omniscient to be able to do that.
There's impossible things that would have to have happened in order for him to pick up that glove at Bundy and bring it to Rockingham to set up OJ. It didn't happen. It's just not possible. So, no, I don't think he did.
So it's possible that he's a horrible person and is innocent
and
of...
And did his job that day.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
Unfortunately, it was the kind of thing where it may have been true that, as the defense points out, that Furman saw OJ with Nicole and didn't like the cross-racial relationship. It's very possible that that's true. But to have masterminded a conspiracy to actually frame OJ in the minutes that he had to, you know, pick up a glove when nobody else was looking and, you know, secret it over to the other place and then throw it down on the ground and then have, you know, and then discover it when he didn't even know where OJ was at the time.
Right.
It's just ridiculous. I really loved Mr. Goldman's statement about this is no longer a trial about the man who killed my son. It really pointed out the fact that the defense was successfully able to make the trial all about all of these issues around and not the issue of this trial, which is murder. And most likely first-degree murder, because it would have taken some planning to do this, particularly, as we'll talk about later, if we think the way that it went down. I mean, we've discussed some of it, but it would have taken some planning, which would have made it premeditated murder. So the fact is that I still believe that Mr. Goldman and his daughter were very present reminders. I remember during the actual trial itself years ago that when they did give infrequent press interviews, or when they were seen coming in to the courtroom and going, you saw that deeply ingrained grief in their faces all the time. There was no acting, there was no joy in their life. There was all just pain and grief. And so many instances throughout that trial where they were just slapped in the face over and over again.
I think it must be one of the hardest things, you know, listening to a trial that's about your loved one and them not featuring it in it at all, and seeing all the grandstanding, seeing all these arguments that have been, you know, brought up to create distraction and deviate from the real matter. And that's certainly what we see the team, the defence team doing. And some might say they're doing their job. But actually, it still remains there are two people who lost their lives. And when those issues aren't being talked about, but everything else is, therein lies the major problem and the problems with the criminal justice system, which still stand. These are not new things. They're not things that are no longer current, sadly. These are things that we still see every day. So there's still a lot of things that need to be tackled in the way that people behave at trial, and evidence that, you know, certainly forensic science has come a long way. And, yeah, you know, we're going to talk about that some more, because, you know, when we think about reasonable doubt, you know, most of the time, yes, you can have cases that are built on circumstantial evidence, but now most of the time lends itself to forensic science.
Yeah, there's the whole CSI effect now. CSI would never have made it. The show would never have made it at the time, because basically the standards and practices of crime scene investigation, collection of evidence, were not very standard. And obviously the mistakes that were made, the issues that happened in this case, had been repeated hundreds of thousands of times across the country. But the defendant in those trials didn't have 10 high-paid lawyers fighting their cause. And so they went to jail based on, even with these poor forensic collection techniques. So this case actually did have one positive effect, which was it started a very rigorous training and execution practices for criminal crime scene investigation evidence recovery. I think the FBI had been doing it for years at that time, but not every small jurisdiction in the United States did.
I think this, you know, nine harked back to what Darden said, which is, you know, it's about storytelling and it's how you tell your story. And, you know, does it really come down to that? Well, it appears to. You know, it appears to come down to who's got the best story or the best narrative. But what about that thing called the truth? Hmm. You know, and that's what we opened with on this particular episode, and the truth just seems to be, again, a footnote. Maybe it didn't even make the footnote.
Right.
It's about creating, you know, other stories and other narratives so that people are so blindsided they actually forget what they're there deciding upon.
I think that's absolutely true. Yeah, we just had to, you know, put up with the fact that the defense gets to do whatever they want and the prosecution is limited to the truth. Obviously, there were dozens and dozens of instances and press conferences and manipulations on the part of the defense the prosecution didn't engage in at all. And that is generally how it's done. And Judge Ito could have controlled this case by demanding that nobody on the defense team actually participates in any press conference about what's going on in this trial until after the trial's over. It's done thousands of times across this country, and it should have been done in this case. There is one positive note in this episode that I think Laura probably will want to talk about, and that is the fact that Marsha, during the course of this episode, got full custody of her children. It just shows that she had her hands full, not only with this trial, but her family as well.
I mean, it certainly did. I think it showed a number of things, and I think they did it particularly well. that one, you know, when you're in this kind of profession, you're doing this work, just how all-consuming it is, that the personal life takes a backseat, that even though she's dealing and juggling with so many things, that, you know, when she's told that the verdict is out, she is confused about, you know, what the woman's talking about. And then she says, you know, in your own case. And you can see that it's sort of on the priority list, probably number, you know, 15, because she's juggling so many things. And then when she finds out that she does get custody, she's hugely relieved. But the way that it ends, you know, it's almost just a... It's a very sudden explosion back into her personal life. And obviously then that particular episode ends, and it's a reminder of just how much she's juggling at that time.
Right, and I have to admit that when I watched the trial, the original trial, I remember seeing... I don't think I ever read anything about Marcia's hair or her attire or anything like that. I don't remember seeing anything like that covered in the news. But I remember seeing her appearance change over the course of the trial. And I always thought that she looked angry, and that I said, it's too bad we can't actually see the faces of the jury, because I would like to see, are they responding to her? Because I, as a viewer of this trial, wasn't responding to her. And I thought she needed to be much more concerned about what they were seeing. And I thought she was more concerned, because I saw her appearance change. I thought, oh, she's only concerned about being on TV, and she's not concerned about the jury, and that's a big mistake. But, of course, I didn't know all the things that were going on behind the scenes. I thought she was just doing that on her own, and she was...
For vanity, and yeah. Not for...
But you see, she wasn't holding her own press conference, was she?
Talking about all
the issues that were facing her, although her ex-husband did hold a press conference, right. Which I'm sure she needed like a nail in the head right. At the time.
No, I know. And like I said, I only saw parts of it, because actually, in fact, I was in Fort Marcy Park for months with Dr. Lee doing the Vince Foster investigation at the time. But the things that I saw was probably the recap summaries that I saw. I didn't know that all this stuff was going on, you know, them attacking the press, the media attacking her for her appearance. I didn't know that, obviously, that she had a custody battle going on. But now, when I look at it in retrospect, knowing all the things that she was juggling, I do respect her tremendously, because it would have been a lot easier for her to just bow out gracefully and just say, I'm not doing this anymore, I can't do this, and actually... It would have caused a mistrial. It would have been a major disaster for the DA's office, but it would have been reasonable under the circumstances. I had no idea everything that was going on, but certainly, but when, you know, her ex-husband's mother leaked pictures of her on a topless beach, I mean, that's just outrageous. And she had to put up with that. She had to put up with what her ex-husband was saying, the statements that he was saying to the court, in order to try to manipulate a family court to give him custody of their children. I mean, just outrageous behavior.
It's almost a perfect storm, though, isn't it? Mm-hmm. That, you know, I'm not saying that she made the best decisions at times, and I'm certainly, you know, not saying that she's perfect in any way, but I do think that she had a much tougher path to walk than others in this particular case. And, of course, we learn far more about her personal life, you know, as we get to... Episode 10, the final, which tells us the reason why, you know, she put up with so much was because of her, born out of her own experience.
Yes.
So we're going to discuss that in more detail. But I think it's a very interesting thing that, you know, and it's just, I'm literally just passing an observation on it, that we did talk about the Marcia series, that why is it that so much about her is under scrutiny? You know, or even at the time, why is that? Because, you know, when she is juggling so much, and I agree with Jim, you don't know what's going on in someone's personal life. They're there to do a job. But, you know, I defy anybody to deal with the things that she was dealing with and still being able to walk into court and still give the performance of her life. I mean, it's a tough call. Whereas yeah. You've got Cochrane, who's, you know, the polished showman, but he's got a team of, you know, other experts working with him. And the pressures seem, yes, he's got pressures, but and they come to bear a little bit when the domestic violence incident comes to light. But he's Teflon. I mean, he just manages to brush it off.
That's
and people
right.
allow that to happen.
Right.
And it's more the other people around, the silence that colludes, you know, and kind of enables this kind of behavior
right.
that is the thing that I think we should be calling out.
It's sexist, isn't it, Laura?
Well, the you know, ism is there again. Yeah. And, you know, I do feel that she was singled out in every way. Everything about her came under attack. Mm-hmm. And it's one thing when your professionalism's being attacked, but it's another thing when you personally are under attack and you've got people lining up because there are things that are on their agenda or in their interests, you know, to stand in line and you know, take a blow at that person.
Right.
This was a tough job and a tough case. But, of course, you know, they did have overwhelming evidence too. But some of those decisions, you know, that were made, you know, I do query because the domestic violence history and context should have been right up front and centre stage with the victims right in the middle of it. And, you know, I'm not sure that, well, in fact, I know that was not achieved.
Right.
So I'm not saying she's perfect in any way.
Right. But certainly we feel that the fact that this was a ongoing pattern of behavior should have been forefront in this trial because it does also help prove premeditation. And it was clearly a well-documented history, not only with 9 calls to the police, but with photographs, with diary entries that certainly should have illuminated the judge and the jury on what was going on here, but it never got to that.
Absolutely. And the way we hear about Nicole, and, you know, we did two sessions on that specifically, particularly Lisa and I, you know, for me, there are parallels with the way that Nicole was treated and the way that Marsha was treated. You know, we're talking about very similar issues, but sadly, in one of them, there were much more dangerous repercussions and consequences. But you are seeing, you know, control being exercised on Marsha, no doubt because of her gender. And, you know, it's the very issues that are at the heart of this trial that we're seeing being played out on her in her personal and professional life. So it's somewhat ironic for me seeing that.
So, but I would like to thank everybody for listening. And I want to give a shout out to our new podcast host, Wondery.
Yay!
It's great to be one of their very first podcasts, original programming. And we are really excited about all the new technology and the ability to do so many more things and expand our podcast so that everybody can hear it. And we really thank all of our listeners for coming back for more and more and more.
That's right. Thanks, you guys.
Yeah, and please stay tuned because our next episode, we're going to cover the finale of People versus O.J. Simpson. Laura, do you have any shout-outs today?
Well, yes, there was one thing that was on my radar is that we've talked about lots of different shows that people should watch. And, you know, Lisa and I seem to be in sync in that. And certainly in other shows, I've mentioned shows. But one of the things that I didn't mention was the book that I co-authored with 2 police officers, which was published in 2009, called Policing Domestic Violence, which was published by Oxford University Press. And, you know, it's not just a book for police or law enforcement. It's much wider than that. There's lots of case studies in there, but it talks about what does an effective investigation look like? What should a call handler do? You know, what's the good practice around working with victims and also profiling perpetrators? Domestic homicide reviews as a chapter, children as victims as well, and so-called honour-based abuse and stalking. So it's all the good practice that was consolidated into one book. So I completely forgot that I should mention that, so I'm going to mention it and,
glad you did.
And recommend it.
And Lisa?
Nope, I don't have anything this week. Go ahead, Jim.
Thanks again, and we will be back with another episode of Real Crime Profile. Take care.
For advice or support, if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0207 840 8960 or go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter, safety or counselling, call the Genesis 24-hour hotline 214 946 4357 or go on the website www.genesisshelter.org, or you can call the National Domestic Violence Hotline on 800 799 7233.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan, engineered by Jacob Moose Molin. Music is composed and performed by Simba Sumba. Logo art by Rob Cohen. Real Crime Profile is produced and recorded at Empire Studios LA by XG Productions. Real Crime Profile is distributed by Wondery.